Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. I'm here with my co-host, Alfred Addis, bringing you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events for Thursday, June 19th, 2014. Last night, we did our interview with James Corbett of the Corbett Report, and that will begin shortly right after my market report and update, so please stay tuned. It's a very interesting interview with Mr. James Corbett, and of course, the main topic was Iraq, and certainly Iraq is in the news today, but first, let's get right to the market report today. Gold had a big day today. Gold, currently, looking at the New York spot price, up $40.90 at $1,319 off the high of $1,322. Silver was up 86 cents today at 20.87 off the high of 21.04. Platinum up $22 at 14.77. Palladium up 12 at 841. What's really interesting and exciting about these numbers is we had big moves in the precious metals, but yet the rest of the markets were basically unchanged. No big drops in the Dow, no big increases in oil. Is this in relationship strictly to Iraq? I'm not so sure. I think there's other things that are going on. Because normally if it was in relationship to what we're seeing and going on with Iran, you would have other markets reacting at the same time, and we don't have that today. So either the plunge protection team was so busy at keeping the other markets from collapsing, they didn't have time to bother with gold and the precious metals today, and therefore we saw this nice pop today. So again, the USDX today was trading down just slightly, 0.06 at 80.34. Crude oil, it's up still under a dollar, 0.65 at 106.62. I didn't look to see what Brent, that might be higher. No one focuses on the Brent crude anymore because that number is so high, but yet that is the sweet crude, that is the prime crude. It's the nice crude to have and really the important number for oil prices when you're pricing your oil. So that last time I saw a peak at that was about 114, but still no really big $2 gains or $3 gains. I know in Iraq they were fighting over the one refinery. I do believe one of the largest gas refineries, was shut down earlier in the day, showing pictures of long lines, 500 cars plus in line waiting for gasoline in Iraq. But I have since read that The government still controls that refinery, and whether it's back online or not, I don't know. But still, no big, huge jumps in crude oil, which, again, not supporting any other big moves for the precious metals. Let's see what the paper markets finally did today. You know, they're still nickel and diming these record highs for the S&P and the Dow. The Dow edged up, 14 points, 16,921. The NASDAQ was down 3 at 43.59. The S&P was up 2 at 19.59. Yes, it set another record high, but, they're nickel and diming it to death with these small little gains. So, they just inch one out. I mean, they had like 2021 record highs and, all by, if you average it out, only by a couple points, just like what we've seen today, in order to reach those highs. 10-year yield today, 0.01 at 2.62%. So, again, no big changes in the 10-year yield and the stock markets. And, of course, gold and silver were certainly the exciting markets to follow today. One of the reasons we could also look to, we all know that the London Metal Exchange is, they're offering three alternatives to the silver fix. And tomorrow they're supposed to release some more information about this. So perhaps this is the prelude to this announcement. They basically have three alternatives to the fix. One is the London Metal Exchange. They want to enhance the existing method. They're looking for an electronic platform, and they're also looking, the exchange could use its open outcry floor for the silver fix. So those are the three options that they have. And as we all know, the silver price benchmark, or the London fix, is going to cease on August 14th. You have the main operator, the London Silver Market Fixing, said last month that they're looking to see what they can do. And the reason is that the big scrutiny of price setting that is beginning to intensify across these markets. You have the London Metal Exchange is owned by the Hong Kong Exchanges and Clearing. They have made proposals as being the alternative to the current telephone-based method with better auditing and compliance. So this could be a lot what's going on in the markets today. If this is a sampling of how the markets will change with the fix, you guys better, as Al says, buckle up and get your positions, because I think anything, we can see anything in these markets transform. Let's see, any other... Now, what they're going to do, they're going to decide which proposal will be adopted. And I guess there have been 10 different entities that have presented their method for fixing the price of silver at a seminar. That is to be tomorrow, June 20th. And they said they will shortlist the best proposals beforehand. So they're also going to test this market the middle of July. So we can see a lot of exciting things happen. August 15th is not that far away. And so make sure you get positions. We're still running this special. Even with the high prices today, we have a few more left. $888 based on yesterday's prices for an almost uncirculated $5 Liberty gold piece, a tube of 1 ounce silver eagles, plus your free silver eagle, and the shipping is all included in the price of $888. As one of our most popular specials, they go out the door like crazy. So at this low, low, low price, again, gold's up $40 and you're getting it at yesterday's prices. We do have a limited amount at that price. So you better give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. And I just want to encourage you all to go to our website at dgscoins.com. Make sure you sign up for the weekly newsletter. And you can also listen to these programs that are archived on a daily and weekly basis. So again, exciting news in the precious metals, I think, and very much in relationship to the silver fix coming out of London tomorrow. And if we see these type of numbers move prior to, I can only imagine when you have some more geopolitical problems that come to the forefront, like Iraq and Ukraine and everything else that's going on in the Middle East. And let's not forget about Northern Africa, what's going on there. I mean, you don't hear anything or very much coming out of that territory. There's problems, folks. Lots and lots of problems. And these problems happen quick. Things change on a dime. And if you're not positioned, get protected. If you want to be in the paper markets, that's fine. Just get it insured with gold and silver. I wouldn't be there with all the rigging and inside trading and everything that is that faces for the rest of this year and the beginning of next year. I think the markets, they're primed for a big drop. But we're going to be heading off into the interview with last night with James Corbett. Make sure you give us a call at 800-375-4188. We'll be back tomorrow. We have lots and lots of things to talk about tomorrow, a lot of exciting things going on. Call me if you have any questions or if you want to discuss your portfolios. Give us a call at our 800 number. I'd love to talk to you. Good evening, James.
Well, hello, guys. Thanks for having me back on. Always a pleasure to be here.
Mm-hmm. Hi, James. Well, I think one of the first things we can talk about tonight is probably Iraq. All right. Fascinating. I mean, it just becomes curiouser and curiouser. And before we do, matter of fact, let's give folks a little better introduction for James. He's the author, publisher of the Corbett Report, which is for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. He's also the editorial writer of the International Forecaster, the weekly electronic newsletter created by the recently deceased economic analyst Bob Chapman. You can find the Corbett Report at corbettreport.com. C-O-R-B-E-T-T, isn't that right?
That is correct, sir.
Corbettreport.com. Given that the invaders going into Iraq, at least some portion of them, are operating under the name of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. Has the Iraqi war spread from Syria to Iraq? Or will the Iraqi war spread from Iraq to Syria to help overthrow the Assad regime? What's happening here? What's the relationship between Syria and Iraq in this case?
Well, very, very good question, and that's a very good way of framing it, because I think you're exactly right. It's going to go both ways. We see the conflict in Syria spilling over into Iraq, and that's going to give the excuse for would-be foreign interveners to go into Syria, because after all, ISIS is based there as well. So it is a convenient situation for those who have been looking to put their boots on the ground there in Syria, as well as people who are still itching to finish the job in Iraq, so to speak. And I've been saying in some of my work recently that I think this is really what the ultimate mission accomplished has always been about in Iraq. It's always been about trying to split the country into three warring factions, the Sunnis, the Shias, and the Kurds. And I think this is just going to be the cherry on top as the country starts to fall apart under the strain, because, of course, we now have this Wahhabist Sunni terrorist element that's taking over the country bit by bit. And, of course, is probably going to be turned away from Baghdad. I don't think that Baghdad's going to fall as easily as Mosul and some of the other cities have fallen. But it probably will start the division of the country between the Kurdish north and then the Sunni areas in the central and more northerly areas. The southern Shia areas are probably going to remain.
I'm going to be reconnecting.
Then it should just take a moment, folks, but James is calling from Japan.
Testing.
Yep, hello? We're back in business.
Okay, all right, good.
We probably lost the last three, four sentences that you said there. Why don't you go ahead and talking about, again, Iraq and this relationship to Syria. And you were talking about you think that Iraq will break down into three separate, or at least it may break down into three separate sections, even nations. Is that, am I correct in understanding that?
Sir, it's breaking.
We're still having that problem. Frank, I blame you.
All right, hold on. Maybe I have a solution.
There he is.
I'll be back.
Now he's better. Now,
oh, is
ahead,
that okay?
Yes.
Yeah, I guess so.
The wonders of modern technology. It allows these conversations halfway around the world.
It's remarkable, though. It is really remarkable that you can be talking halfway around the world. And even if you have a few glitches here, there, and whatever, it's really remarkable technology.
I don't take it for granted. It's quite a remarkable age we're living in. All right, well, back to the matter at hand.
Will Iraq break down into three separate nations, or what's going to happen here? What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I think I don't know if that's going to happen, but I do think that that has been on the cards for even since.
Just let Frank reconnect with James.
The remarkable technology usually does a good job, but tonight the remarkable technology is perhaps not quite so remarkable.
Well, we've had those severe sunspots last week. I don't know if it could be an overflow from that, whatever, but we'll see if we can't get them reconnected.
You know what you have to do about those sunspots, Melody?
Wear sunglasses.
You have to get the guests to wear sunscreen.
Tell them before they
pick up the telephone or the Skype connection or whatever, they have to put on a thick layer of sunscreen to protect us and the program.
Along with the foil.
Absolutely.
Yes.
All right. So where are we? And have we made some sort of a reconnection yet with James or not? To connect or not connect, that is the question. Frank, we need an answer.
It doesn't seem, obviously, it isn't James's.
Okay, right. But you got to play the Jew's harp, so we've got some music to dance. You can't just dance without any music, Frank.
Well, let's keep going, because this basically will be aired, I think.
All right, let's take something here that might be interesting to people. I've got a copy. You can go to Google Earth. Most of you probably have it on your computer. You can zoom in on the Middle East and take a look at the map where you see Iraq and Syria. And when you look at the map and you see this, you can see the Syria borders on the east end of the Mediterranean, and Iraq borders on the west end of the Persian Gulf. And when you look at this and you see the two countries butt up against the side of each other, you can see that it's kind of a natural, it's almost a natural result that Syria and Iraq would somehow be combined into a single nation that spanned all the way from the eastern end of the Mediterranean to the western end of the Persian Gulf. And you look at it, and it looks like a natural thing. It's the sort of thing where if there are people in the Arab communities, Syria and Baghdad, or Syria and Iraq, if they're dreaming of some sort of a glorious nation, you know, there is a kind of inevitability in the map that suggests Syria and Iraq would combine. And this is consistent with this army, the Islamic State of Syria and Iraq. They're not kidding. They maybe want these two nations to combine, and I can see there's a kind of logic to it. And you could throw in Kuwait, add Kuwait to the other end of the part of the Persian Gulf, and you'd have something pretty powerful. They might. All right, James.
Yes, I'm back.
All right, good. While you were gone, I was just explaining to Melody, when you left and we had the garbled communication, we were talking about whether or not Iraq was going to break down into three mm-hmm. separate areas, possible nations, whatever, whether that was possible. But I was explaining, you look at the map of the Middle East and you consider the relationship of Syria to Iraq, and you can see Syria is from the east end of the Mediterranean, and Iraq touches the west end of the Persian Gulf. There is almost a kind of inevitable logic that Syria and Iraq would be combined into a single nation. I can imagine the people that are pushing for that, they have a kind of the same thing that pushed the United States all the way from the Atlantic to the Pacific Ocean. It would capture the imagination. What do you think about that? Are we going to see a single major nation? And we've got 30 seconds before we're going to take a break. I don't know if you want to start the answer right now or go ahead. start it?
Well, I can start anyway. But I would say that the Sunni elements, the Sunni faction, the Sunni grouping within Syria and the Sunni grouping within Iraq would certainly make a connection. But again, Syria has been a Shia country, or at least a Shia predominant country, which puts it more in Iran's sphere of influence. So Iran has a lot invested in this game. And Saudi Arabia does, too, as the home and birthplace of Wahhabist Sunniism. So they've been funding and supporting and training and equipping and supplying the ISIS-type soldiers and forces in Syria since the Syrian insurgency began. So we're seeing some very interesting groupings that are happening right now.
This really is a fascinating subject. You look at this and you begin to understand the geopolitics here. And you don't have to be profoundly knowledgeable. You can look at this and you can say, oh my gosh. You know, you can see it's a problem. Let's take a break for some commercial announcements. I'm Alfred Adusk with Melody Cederstrom on Financial Survival with our guest, James Corbett. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
A heart condition and emergency rooms and medical doctors are not an option, you need our emergency heart attack kit. 5 concentrated liquid formulas enter the system in 60 seconds to protect your heart muscle, strengthen heartbeat, increase circulation, relieve pain, and make breathing easier. When seconds count, you want all the help you can get with our emergency heart attack kit. Easy to use and portable in a 1-pound compact kit for your purse, briefcase, or car. Call Apothecary Herbs now for your emergency heart attack kit, toll-free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at www.thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adusk here on Financial Survival with co-host Melody Cederstrom, and our guest is James Corbett calling in from Japan, and we're talking about the current situation in Iraq and potentially Syria, and there are a lot of potential. You know, there is so much more here as a potential than we see in the news right now. The potentials are enormous. What do you think, James? Is the potential just fantasy, or how serious is this?
Well, the potential, as you say, is pretty earth-shaking. There are some very strange bedfellows being made in this situation right now, and we've seen Iran, for example, siding with the U.S. The U.S. and Iran are talking about cooperating in terms of defending Baghdad from and repelling ISIS, because they both have an interest in seeing the current status quo being maintained. And that's, I mean, an interesting development in and of itself. And as we were saying just before the break, the Saudis are on the other side of this. They're more sympathetic towards the ISIS invading troops, who probably a lot of them were supplied and trained and funded, if not directly Saudi themselves. So there's some very interesting things going on right now. And I think, again, this plays into a much, much larger geopolitical situation that's continuing to develop, as the Saudi regime has been moving further and further to distance itself from the U.S. in recent months. And we've seen some of those moves. For example, they rejected the seat on the Security Council as a protest against the U.S. and the fact that it wouldn't invade Syria. And we've seen them, for example, cozying up more and more to China in recent months, which, again, is an interesting development as China overtakes the U.S. to become the world's largest oil importer. This is, again, some pretty important and profound shifts that are happening right now. It doesn't necessarily mean that the final wedge has been driven between the Saudis and the U.S. They're just announcing a new $60 billion arms deal, the largest arms deal in Saudi-U.S. relations history. So I don't think that Saudi is quite ready to back out from the U.S. military umbrella right now. But the fact that they're even toying with that idea would have been unthinkable even just a few short years ago, as, of course, the Saudi-U.S. alliance is the backbone of the petrodollar regime. So, again, this has ramifications that go completely around the world and to the heart of not only the geopolitical scene, but the financial scene. And so what takes place in Iraq and Syria in the coming weeks and months, I think, is going to have some pretty profound effects, no matter which way it goes.
Are we looking at a secular war where we have people fighting over oil and economics and so on? Or are we looking at a holy war? They say sectarian, they'll admit it's a sectarian war. But do the Sunnis see this as waging holy war on the Shiites?
This is obviously the way that the majority of the people who are actually involved in the fighting do see it. And I think that this is quite obvious and reflected in the types of atrocities that are committed and the things that are being done exactly as they have been being done in Syria before this point, and now spilling over into Iraq. I think that the fighters on the ground are very much motivated by religious sentiment. But having said that, again, this type of religious factionalism would not have the training, the funds, the ability to operate in the way that it does without significant state support. And I think we see that quite clearly in the fact that ISIS, this in all extents and purposes, this is a tiny ragtag band of a couple thousand fighters that, by no means should be able to overrun Iraqi security to the extent that they have. But this, of course, speaks to the incredible backing, training, funding, equipment, and basically organization that is that ISIS has going for it in its momentum right now. And this is the official story is that this is all coming from some $429 million bank heist they were able to perpetrate, and now they're the best funded terror group in the world. But that is a load of baloney, and demonstrably so. ISIS real funding and backing can be seen going back now several years, and does include state cooperation from Saudi Arabia, obviously, from Qatar, from some of the other, the GCC, the Gulf Council countries, and also the United States. And this is a recently breaking story in the last 24 hours that there's now been confirmation that the U.S. military base or a military base that the U.S. was operating at on the Jordan-Syrian border was used to train ISIS fighters back in 2012-2013 mm-hmm. timeframe. And this is an important story because even the existence of that base and the fact that the U.S. was there was something that was completely ignored by the mainstream media for over 2 years, or for a year and a half, I should say. When it was first reported back in 2011 by BoilingFrogsPost.com, and I did a video with one of the people who were blowing the whistle on the fact that U.S. military, including British and French forces, were training Syrian resistance fighters, quote unquote, i.e. terrorists, in Jordan back in 2011, it was finally picked up by The Guardian in 2013. So there was official confirmation on that story. And just now in the last 24 hours, they're starting to say, oh, it looks like some of the ISIS fighters were actually trained by the U.S. in Jordan. But don't worry, the ISIS fighters that were trained were screened for Al-Qaeda extremism before they were given training. So apparently that's supposed to alleviate this fact. But again, it just goes to show that that what's happened in Syria and what is now spilling over into Iraq has been done with an incredible amount of funding, training, arming, equipping, and logistics support that has gone into making this fighting possible. So to whatever extent these people are motivated by religious fervor, that religious fervor is now being backed up and aided and sponsored and basically pushed by these major states.
What you're talking about is that the United States has played a role in at least training and perhaps funding the ISIS invaders of Syria. At the same time, the United States is presumably being asked to help defend Iraq from the ISIS invaders. We're playing both sides of the game on this. Is that true?
Well, this should probably not be a surprise to people who are familiar with how U.S. foreign policy works. But yes, this is exactly what's happening. Of course, on the surface, they have to say that they're against these terrorists when they're invading Iraq. But these are the exact same terrorists who were on the side of the freedom fighting that was supposedly going on in Syria. And again, this type of two-faced approach to terrorism, it's good when it's on our side, it's bad when it's on the other side, is a phenomenon that's absolutely nothing new. And it goes back, of course, to Reagan having the Taliban into the White House in the 1980s and calling them the freedom fighters. And of course, when they become on the other side of the table, then suddenly they're the terrorists. And again, it's just a label that's slapped on or taken off as needed. And I think we see that most clearly in this situation where the U.S. has had this uneasy relationship that's been difficult to explain with these terrorist factions that are quite explicitly tied to Al-Qaeda. Going back again to the Libyan situation, a lot of that spilled over from Libya to Syria and now from Syria to Iraq. And the U.S. has been actively cooperating with these groups the entire time.
The implication is that we want war in the Middle East. We're telling the rebels, why don't you invade? We're telling the Shiites, why don't you fight? The implication is we want a war in the Middle East.
This is
and
not
are we talking about only how big a war are we talking about right now? Is it regional or just Syria and Iraq? Is that as far as it goes? Or can this break loose? And what happens to Iran before this is all over?
Well, again, we don't have to speculate too much about this. We can look to some of the documentation that's come out about this before, and a lot of people would point back to the Project for a New American Century, which was an organization of neocons that formed in the late 1990s and included, of course, Cheney and Pearl and Wolfowitz and all of the people who got into power in the Bush administration, who in the late 1990s were penning letters to Bill Clinton saying, you have to go and invade Iraq and finish the job and all of this. And of course, they got into positions of power. And as we know now, from day one in the Bush administration, they were looking for any excuse to try to invade Iraq. And of course, that came gift wrapped for them on 9/11. But it goes back even further than that. And a lot of people point to an article that was published in the World Zionist Organization's publication called Kuvunim. I have no idea how to pronounce that. But it was published in 1982 by an Israeli journalist who had links to the Israeli Foreign Ministry called Oded Yanon. And this plan specifically talked about Israel's foreign policy interests in seeing what would the exact type of breakup that we're now seeing in Syria and Iraq. And for reading from that article, he wrote, quote, the dissolution of Syria and Iraq into ethnically or religiously unique areas, such as in Lebanon, is Israel's primary target on the Eastern Front. Iraq, rich in oil on the one hand and internally torn on the other, is guaranteed as a candidate for Israel's targets. Its dissolution is even more important for us than that of Syria. Iraq is stronger than Syria. In the short run, it is Iraqi power which constitutes the greatest threat to Israel. And that, again, was written in 1982. And I think we see the development of this imperial logic that is always about trying to divide and conquer and to keep the conquered elements fighting with each other rather than posing any sort of regional dominance threat. And this is exactly why Iraq and Iran were played off against each other in the 1980s. And I think that's exactly why we're seeing the dissolution of Syria and Iraq and the entire region really into these quibbling religious factions, because, again, it keeps this entire region divided so that no one will be able to rise up that would be able to pose any sort of threat to the Anglo-American NATO-Israeli dominance that the region currently is under right now.
Iran is a Shiite nation. Iraq is Shiite predominantly. I'm not sure about Syria. I'm going to assume, what is Syria? Primarily Sunni or Shiite, do you know?
Syria is primarily Shiite. It has been run by the Al-Assad family as a Alawite minority that has been in ruling power for decades now, and has maintained a balance between Sunni and Shia factions. But it is a Shia majority country and has been in the orbit of Iran as a result, and has been Iran's land bridge to Lebanon and its forces there. So, again, it's been a very important part of the Sunni crescent, and as a result, Saudi Arabia and Qatar and some of those other states have been very interested in seeing Syria split up and fighting with itself, because, again, it's a key part of the sort of Sunni dominance for the region.
And that's an important point, because Shia dominates these Iran, Iraq, and Syria, but Sunnis are the vast majority of the Muslim faith. Isn't that correct? I've seen estimates that the Sunnis are 90% of the Muslims in the world are Sunnis.
There is a larger proportion of Sunnis than Shias. That is true.
So we have to wonder whether the Sunnis of the world, in a sense, that might be too big a scope, but are the Sunnis of the world out? We're going to get those Shiites and finish them off. And point here is, assuming the ISIS forces overcome Iraq, what's the chances that we see a nation of Syria and Iraq combined into a single Islamic state? And once that happens, can we expect them to go after Iran?
Well, it would be a logical conclusion. That, I think, could not happen without an incredible amount of support from some of its the state allies that have the interest in seeing that happen. So I don't think that would just be a spontaneous development. And to people,
no, it wouldn't happen easily, but
it certainly wouldn't. But to people who understand this region better than I do, and people who have lived there and understand the culture, they say that the Sunni-Shia divide is real to an extent, but it is often overplayed in Western analysis. And what we're really dealing with is this extremist Wahhabist Sunni, which is a vast minority of Sunni Muslims. And this is an ideology that, again, has been fostered by the Saudi regime and is largely sponsored by them. And it's where we get Al-Qaeda and all of these related organizations like ISIS. And so it is not, I mean, it's been very common in a lot of these countries to have Sunni-Shia marriages and all of these types of things. And we've seen Sunnis and Shias coexisting in places like Iraq and Syria and other such countries for a very long time. But what we're seeing is now the radicalization and the insertion of these extremist elements that are going to force the issue. So I think, again, this has to be seen in the rubric of outside intervention and how that's shaping these forces, because I don't think it's necessarily that Sunnis and Shias are at each other's throats or ever have been to the extent that they're being pushed. And we see that from, for example, what happened in the disintegration of Iraq after the 2003 invasion. And we saw the provocations like the bombing of the Golden Mosque in 2006, which it has been largely talked about was an operation specifically designed to ignite Sunni-Shia tensions and to get the country divided and fighting with itself, which did work. And we saw an increase in the sort of insurgency operations after that point. So, again, this is, I think, something that's being provoked into existence more so than it's something that's fundamentally there in the culture.
All right. We have heard Senator McCain back, it might have been a decade ago now, but he was singing bomb, 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 Iran. And we have listened to the United States and Israel for 6 years or more complain that Iran is on the verge of creating nuclear weapons and we got to bomb them right now. I want to know, Is Iran more likely, if Iran had nuclear weapons, are they more likely to use them on Israel or on the United States, on Saudi Arabia, or on the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria? Are they most likely to use those nuclear weapons on? Because they may be threatened more by Iraq, by ISIS, than they are by Israel or the United States.
Well, it's an interesting question, but I think it presumes quite a lot. I mean, the question would be, why is Iran using these nuclear weapons? And if we're going by history as any indication, how many times has Iran actively invaded another country in the last
virtually unknown.
Exactly, as opposed to the United States or its allies. And of course, I mean, the big unspoken truth of the entire Middle Eastern
region. Let's save the big unspoken truth for after this break. We'll be back with James Corbett with the big unspoken truth in just a moment on Financial Survival. Please stay tuned.
Countries have denied internet access for their people during civil strife. The FCC seized in-use commercial shortwave frequencies right after the September 11th attacks. No one communication system can be depended on to be there when you need information. You need choices. You need a Ku band free-to-air satellite system from AVR. The AVR system includes a receiver, an LNB, and a 75-centimeter dish. All you need to get on your own is the coaxial cable. The system is delivered to your door for $149.99. That's right, delivered for $149.99. That's the shipping and the system, $149.99. Call 541-225-4659. That's 541-225-4659. Or visit AmericanVoiceRadio.com and click Satellite System.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Folks, I'm Alfred Addis here with Melody Cedarstrom on Financial Survival with our guest James Corbett calling from Japan, talking about Iraq. James was going to tell us the big unspoken truth when we broke for commercials. So what is it?
Well, the big unspoken truth about the Middle East is that it is already a nuclear militarized region, and there is only one nation in that region that has nuclear weapons, and it is the only nation in the region that is not a signatory to the UN's Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and thus is not subject to inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency. It is also the sole holdout of a plan that's been on the table since the 1960s. For a Middle East nuclear weapon-free zone, which was formalized in a joint declaration by Egypt and Iran in the General Assembly in 1974. It is, of course, Israel, which has a stockpile of somewhere between 200 and 400 nuclear weapons that have never been officially declared and is to this day, although it is the biggest unspoken truth in all of international relations, is still actually not admitted or denied, not just not talked about as a official part of U.S. Foreign policy. So it is, I think, the thing that underlies all of this. And to the extent that we talk about nuclearization of the Middle East, I think that has to be brought to the forefront before we can have any type of honest discussion about it. But when we talk about, for example, Iran getting the bomb and things like this, and how would they use it, I understand there is the dangers of extremist elements taking control of such nuclear weapons if they were to be constructed. And of course, despite the politicization of the IAEA reports on Iran, there is still no evidence whatsoever that they have actually taken steps towards creation of nuclear weapons. But even if they were to acquire them, I understand there's the danger that some would see of extremist elements taking control of that, non-state actors who would have an interest in trying to set off a war in the region, but by blowing it up in Tel Aviv or what have you. But having said that, if that is the concern, I think the number one concern at the moment would be Pakistan, where, of course, it's a nuclear armed state. It has quite a number of nuclear weapons, and it does have a very volatile situation, politically speaking, and in terms of religious extremists who might have an interest in that type of terror. But of course, Pakistan was actively cooperated with in getting the bomb by the U.S., which actively looked the other way during the whole Khan network operations back in the 70s and 80s. And we have, I mean, the Dutch foreign minister and others have been on record talking about how the CIA knew about the Khan network from the 1970s onwards and actively looked the other way. We have whistleblowers from within the U.S.'s own defense intelligence, Richard Barlow and people like that, who have been completely and utterly silenced and squelched on their attempts to whistleblow about the ways that U.S. officials were warning Pakistanis that the U.S. was on their trail, and other such incidents. So Pakistan has to be looked at in that regard. But it's interesting that it always comes back to Iran. And I think that there's geopolitical reasons why it's always being focused on, for example, Iran, or in the past on Iraq, rather than, for example, on U.S. allies like Pakistan.
We're looking at this from a regional perspective, primarily involving Muslim nations. What about the Muslim immigrants in Europe? Do they play any role in this, or are they just sitting on the sidelines and observing the show from there, but nothing to worry about, nothing to be concerned about? Are they in the mix, or just observers?
I think that there obviously are strong associations between a lot of immigrants, especially recent immigrants, first-generation immigrants, and the countries that they've immigrated from. And these groups often tend to be wheeled out and used for, I think, propagandistic purposes more so than anything else. So that, for example, often you'll have basically Syrian groups in Washington or other places rallying against Assad and calling for U.S. military intervention there. And I want to be clear that I'm certainly not on the side of people like Assad, and I wouldn't stick up for people like Hussein or others who have been tyrants in the region. But I just think that the fact that it always comes back to what the U.S. military can do to solve the situation is pretty interesting in and of itself, an interesting way of framing it. And I saw a very insightful tweet the other day that I retweeted on my own Twitter account from someone who was pointing out the fact that, well, it would be pretty bizarre if BBC had headlines wondering what Russia can do in Syria, and yet they do have headlines wondering exactly that. What can the U.S. do to help Iraq? So again, the blatant double standards that happen here are just quite transparent for anyone who's paying attention, and really speak to the underlying issues of this, which once again goes towards what these outside forces, whether they be U.S. or Saudi or Qatari or what have you, are doing in these various countries to interfere with what's happening there. And as tragic as the situation may be for various people in various countries, why does it fall, for example, to the U.S. to be the policeman of the world and to put the boots on the ground in these situations?
I agree. No one thought that the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand could ultimately precipitate a world war. How many people are seriously thinking that this conflict between Iraq and ISIS and perhaps Syria. Are we looking at the beginning of at least a potential world war, or is this going to be confined to the region of the Middle East?
For now, I'd like to think that this is going to be confined, and I think that there are there need to be a lot more pieces on the table before I think we reach that world war type scenario. But the fact that we are trending towards it, I think, at this point is fairly undeniable. And I think one of the key elements with regards to what happened in Europe there in 1914 wasn't simply that assassination and then the alliances that kind of kicked into gear that started the wars, the machines of war starting up. But it was also, I mean, all of the other interlocking webs around the entire world, and the fact that there were imperial interests in Africa and East Asia and other regions of the globe that suddenly became in play for the great imperial powers. I think that was an underlying element to all of what we saw happening in World War One. And we see, again, I think similar things are happening now. For example, when you look at Africa and you look at the scramble for resources between China and the U.S., or you look at the East Asia region and you look, of course, at what's happening in the South China Sea and other volatile areas. Again, I think we're seeing the worldwide coming together of a lot of different potential flashpoints that is extremely worrying. But on that very note, I'm actually just about to go on RT to do a interview on the subject of what's happening in the Philippines right now. So I'm going to have to go and prepare for that interview.
All right. Well, thanks very much, James, for being
Thank
on
you.
The program. James Corbett from the Corbett Report, corbettreport.com. We'll talk to you again next week, James.
Thank you so
thanks
much
very
for
much.
Having me on.
Right.
Thank
mm-hmm.
you.
Good night.
Bye-bye. Good night.
All right, Melody, what do you think? Are we going to have, is this a potential for world war? Is it a potential for a regional war in the Middle East that goes beyond not just Syria and Iraq, but goes bigger than that? Or is it going to be confined and turn out to be a kind of insurgency that'll be over in a few months or whatever? Where do you see it going?
Well, it seems like a lot of the unrest in various spots has been short term, and certainly you know, although they perhaps didn't come to a conclusion, they've certainly been put to bed. I think it could go either way, Al. I mean, that's my typical answer.
I know, you got me wincing here, Melody. I tell you, it's a good thing this isn't television, because I trying to get an answer.
But I think there's, you know, I do believe that, you know, there's forces behind the scenes, and
well, you know, it's like James pointed out, the United States has played a role.
Yes, they have. I said that last week.
Sides of this, on both sides of this.
Yes.
They're both encouraging and assisting the ISIS rebels.
Yep.
They are allegedly helping to defend the Iraqi Shiites. We're playing both ends against the middle on this, and
not usually the end well.
It appears that we do want a war. We want the Sunnis to go after the Shiites, and we want them to kill each other. All right? I don't know who. I don't know that the government cares who wins, but perhaps they do care who dies. And it may be that we are fostering.
What is it they reap? What do they reap from it?
I have no idea. It's got to have,
I mean, that's,
it has something to do with oil. It has something to do with Russia. It has something to do with Ukraine. You know, it's, I don't know.
Or is it just something that got out of hand?
No, this hasn't gotten out of hand. Because if the information that James was providing, of talking about, they've been training the ISIS rebels back 2-3 years ago. This hasn't gotten out of hand. This is something that could have been stopped 6 months ago or a year ago or 18 months ago or 2 years ago. This isn't out of hand. This is what the powers that be want.
And perhaps
the Muslims, the Muslims are going to pay a serious price for getting drawn into this, allowing their own religious tensions within their own faith. It's made them susceptible to a kind of division, a war, a brutality that is going to be quite possibly horrific before this is all over.
And we have very little reaction. And it's amazing the outcome, the possible outcome of what is happening, and so little reaction around the world in the markets, in gold markets. No,
I don't think people really appreciate what we're looking at. You know, I'm going to guess that prior to World War I, when Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated and there was always tensions down in what became Yugoslavia, the Balkans was always kind of a crazy part of the world. And it was Muslims versus Catholics down there, largely. That was the division. Here we have Muslims, and it's an internal fight within the Muslim faith over. I don't think a lot of people appreciate how serious this is. And yet, I'll just, again, tell you folks, use Google Earth. Take a look at the map. Take a look at Syria. Take a look at Iraq. Look at where it sits and look at the logic of combining these two nations under a single authority and going beyond that. Once it happens, they take out the Shiite elements of Syria, take out the Shiite elements of Iraq. I think this is quite certainly it's arguable, and some people will believe and anticipate and hope that it will happen, that the Sunnis will overcome the Shiites and perhaps exterminate them. Right, this isn't just a little struggle where we're going to go to war and we're going to win a country. Somebody's going to kick somebody's butt, and then we're going to settle down and start doing business. This is holy war potentially, and if it gets out of hand, there are going to be millions of Shiites.
Well, is it
before this is done?
Is it truly holy war, or is it the religion that is being used to manipulate the warriors into thinking it is their religious war, and only to accomplish what the leaders want?
Holy war is in the eyes of the beholder. Yeah, it's like beauty and a bunch of other things. And you can, and if they can convince people that you are fighting for God, they are implacable. That is always the danger in holy war. The holy warrior doesn't care if he dies. He sacrifices life. He doesn't. It's not a situation where he's expects to go home to the wife and kids. He's not even worried about that. He's going to 72 virgins and Allah up in the paradise. That's where he's headed. These people, they become. Well, this has been our night for technical difficulties. And our remarkable technology has failed us a number of times this evening, and most recently, at least in my opinion, it failed us by shutting me off. But
yes,
some people may think that's an improvement. I don't know. In any case, we've had James Corbett. We've talked about Iraq. This is not a small thing. We hear it as if it's a band of rebels that are causing some problems that are almost inexplicable in Iraq. And it's not that. This is the beginning of a war that has been planned and prepared for over a period of years. And you can bet if they've prepared that long, this isn't going to be over easily. It's not going to be ended easily or peacefully. And the real objectives may be far greater than just Iraq and Syria. I'm Alfred Addis here with Melody Cederstrom on Financial Survival. We will be back on Friday. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, and Frank, the producer. Bye-bye.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a thing.